Thank you. Mr. Resnick, please proceed.
Thanks, Your Honor. Your Honor, I would ask the court's indulgence if I go a little bit beyond my 5 minutes on my opening statement.
Please go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Chief Justice and Associate Justices, it has long been determined by our courts that the law against discrimination is remedial social legislation whose overarching goal is to eradicate the cancer of discrimination. As such, it has been consistently stated that the law should be liberally construed for the benefit of deserving plaintiffs. In this regard, affirming the decision of the appellate division below is one more step in providing victims of discrimination, specifically those employed with a handicap who have been denied a reasonable accommodation with an adequate remedy of the law. The plaintiff in this case sustained devastating injuries as a direct result of the school principal's failure to provide Ms. Richter with a simple accommodation through a change in a written schedule to accommodate her serious diabetes condition. However, in spite of this request, hardly an undue burden on the school, the decision of the motion judge below, now reversed by the appellate division, agreed with the defendants that the Ms. Richter did not fall within the cookie cutter definition of an adverse job action, such as a termination, suspension, or demotion, then she has no remedy at all. This cannot be a public policy of this state and has been rejected by most federal courts, the regulations accompanying the LED, this court's dictates in Victor, Royster, Carabello, and the recent appellate division opinion in Delanois, including the model civil jury charges and the appellate division's decision below. In fact, as pointed out by the New Jersey Attorney General, one of the three amicus supporting plaintiff on this appeal, defense position is contrary to the DCR's longstanding interpretation of its regulations governing disability accommodations, its administrative decisions, including those on housing, and all federal circuits but one, including the Third Circuit, which have addressed this issue. And I think that is what Judge LaVecchia was referring to previously in her questioning. Almost 10 years ago to the day, Justice Holmes and Victor versus State recognized that with the right set of facts, requiring a deserving plaintiff to establish a separate adverse job action is inconsistent with the mandates under the New Jersey law against discrimination. The LED's purpose, as she stated, suggests we chart a course to permit plaintiffs to proceed against employers who have failed to reasonably accommodate their disabilities or failed to engage in an interactive process, even if they can point to no adverse employment consequence that's resulted. Though Victor did not provide the factual setting for such a determination, the case before you is the perfect scenario for this court to make a definitive ruling that there is no need to establish an adverse job action in a failure to reasonably accommodate case under the LED. This is so because the failure to provide a disabled employee with a reasonable accommodation is the discriminatory conduct itself and should not prevent a disabled employee with a remedy under the LED. Thus, as determined by the court below, there is no need for a separate adverse job action. This is especially so where a defendant has failed to show, as in this case, any undue burden in providing accommodation and has failed to enter into the interactive process. Creating further roadblocks to victims of discrimination who are required to toil on because of their medical conditions, as suggested by defendants in this case, is anathema to the statute and the pronouncements of this court, which is to make it easier for victims of discrimination to assert their rights, not more difficult. Thus, following defendants' rationale would leave a whole class of disabled persons with no remedy at all. Now, in terms of the ability of a victim of discrimination to recover damages for bodily injuries, also before the court today, it has long been established in cases such as State versus Schmidt that the Workers' Compensation Board has no applicability when there's a viable cause of action under the LED. This becomes especially pertinent with a victim of discrimination such as Ms. Richter has sustained such grievous injuries due to discriminatory conduct, entitling her to a full recovery under the LED consistent with NJSA 10:5-13, which holds that all remedies available in common law tort actions shall be available to prevailing plaintiffs. These remedies are in addition to any provided by this act or any other statute. It should also be recognized that defendants here are only arguing that bodily injury damages are a bar, and have conceded that other components of plaintiff's personal injury claims, such as emotional distress, anxiety, humiliation, or embarrassment, should go to the jury. Even so, we fully agree with the analysis by our amicus, the National Employment Lawyers Association, that the intentional conduct exception has no place in regard to LED actions, where the statute independently provides for recovery of all damages, including those for bodily injury, whether discriminatory conduct was intentional or not. As such, the burden of the substantial certainty test just does not apply. This was understood by Judge Sumner's below, who reiterated, relying on Schmidt from over 20 years ago, that there is no language in the LED that mandates that claims made by employees against employers under it may only be brought under the Workers' Compensation Act. If the legislature had included workers' comp, Judge Sumner stated, to be the exclusive remedy for victims of discrimination, it would not have provided for a jury trial, as well as compensatory and punitive damages. Now, I just want to allude also to what Judge Patterson indicated before as to what might be some type of double recovery, or that there's some kind of waiver if somebody files a workers' comp claim. The fact that somebody is compensated in comp, which has limited recovery, and many, many moons ago when I did workers' comp, I know what the limited recovery is. There's a schedule which provides for damage to an arm, damage to a knee, things like that. That comes nowhere to compensating a victim of discrimination. And therefore, it should not be barred in that respect. I can analogize it to a situation with a union employee, where the union employee may have a claim under the union contract and still is entitled to workers' comp, it's still entitled to collect damages under LED. The other point is that there is a capacity for employers to send employees to workers' comp, in which case it would not be a voluntary act. So I think in this case, and I want to allude to what Judge Albin said, it is one of statutory interpretation. This statute, the LED statute, provides for certain remedies, including all common law remedies permitted under tort actions, and should not deprive a victim of discrimination to any type of compensation if, in fact, he or she receives a workers' comp award. We have never said there should be double recovery, never. What we have said is that there should be recovery, as the Appellate Division determined, in accordance with Section 40, that provides for recovery of 2/3 of what was awarded, less 1/3 for attorney's fees and $750 for costs. So that is the end of my opening statement. I'll be glad to follow up with my argument or to take questions.
Please unmute yourself, Justice Albin.
I have one question. When an employee institutes a workers' comp action and files a third-party action for personal injuries, in that third-party action, if there is a return of damages for bodily injuries, the workers' comp carrier puts a lien. There is a credit. There isn't a double recovery. Am I correct about that? Are you muted? I can't hear you.
You're muted, counsel.
Okay, go ahead. Yes, I can.
Yes, Justice Albin, you're correct. There is not a double recovery.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. Section 40 of the statute does permit for a lien on those proceeds.
And are you arguing that this should proceed in the same fashion, that the same type of credit should be given to the workers' comp carrier from any recovery in the LAD action?
Yes.
Thank you.
Other questions, anyone?
No.
Mr. Resnick, is there anything you wanted to expand on?
Yes, I would like to respond briefly to some of the arguments among my co-counsel. You know, the argument of the board in this case seems to be that if we allow cases to proceed without showing an adverse job action, that will open the floodgates, and there'll be excessive burden on employers, right? I don't buy that argument. It could be said that if we didn't have the LED, there wouldn't be, you know, claims under the LED either. The fact is that I think what the defense are missing in this case is that there has to be a request for a reasonable accommodation, right? In this particular case, it certainly was reasonable. All the principal had to do is to go and change the schedule. That's all he had to do. He could have changed his schedule. He put an X in it later on. He could have possibly put an X in it. So I don't think, you know, that argument holds any weight at all. You know, the fact is that I think one of the justices also alluded to the fact that she had been accommodated. Don't forget, the first marking period, Ms. Richter was not accommodated. She did have to toil on, as is, you know, described by the cases. The second marking period, they did accommodate her. When it came time for the third marking period, the principal said it was a mistake, but he still refused to change it. So, you know, I think that has to be underscored. As far as the interactive process, there was a question about the DCR. And I think maybe Justice Lavecchia had asked about this. Failing to enter into the interactive process is essentially a failure to reasonably accommodate. That's what happened in this case. You know, in the first marking period, now defendants want to forget about the first marking period. In the first marking period, Ms. Richter sent a detailed email to the principal indicating what would happen to her and what's happening to her if she wasn't accommodated, right? Based upon that, he didn't respond. When it came to the third marking period, you know, he said, now there is a question of fact here, but he said, have something to eat if you don't feel well during the fifth marking period, and then you can go on from there. If he had entered into the interactive process, he would have known that it's not the fifth marking period that was a problem. It was the end of the sixth marking period. She needed to have a meal and to check her levels and to not basically just have a snack during the fifth marking period in order to prevent what eventually happened to her at the end of the sixth marking period. So just on that basis alone, there was no interactive process here. And based on that alone, there was a failure to reasonably accommodate. Counsel refers to the ADA. I don't know where that argument comes from. I haven't heard that before. As far as the workers' comp bar, again, and I don't want to repeat my arguments, but the fact is that we're talking about a situation where the statute itself indicates what a victim of discrimination is entitled to. And you know, in fact, there's no reason at all to have deprived Ms. Richter or to deprive Ms. Richter of her entitlement under the LED, which is the only statute that provides for a jury trial and punitive damages as opposed to what she could collect in workers' comp. So to the extent I have some extra time, Chief Chev, I'd like to have a few minutes of rebuttal.
So rebuttal is for movements, and we're limited in that regard. If there's anything else you wanted to add now, go right ahead, and if not, we'll move on to amici.
I think I've covered everything. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm an appellant, not movements. Thank you, Mr. Resnick. Mr. Dwyer.
Thank you, Chief Justice, and may it please the court. If I may, I'm going to jump ahead to the Workers' Comp Act exclusivity bar first, and then if I have time, I'll circle back to the adverse action issue. And with regard to the exclusivity bar, I want to address 3 points. First, I think it's important to recognize the defendants are striving mightily to limit the reach of their argument, but their efforts to do so would do violence to the language of both the LAD and the Workers' Comp Act. First, there's no way you can limit their argument to disability claims or accommodation claims. If their argument is correct, then it would bar claims for particular types of damages, for sexual harassment claims, for racial discrimination claims, for anything. If you had a victim of sexual harassment who said that he was sexually assaulted at work, and you accept defendant's argument, then the claims for physical injuries would have to go through workers' comp and couldn't be part of the LAD claim. So it's a much broader argument than just related to disability. And secondly, this attempt to draw a distinction between bodily injuries and other types of injuries like emotional harm and so forth, again, would do violence to the scheme in the Workers' Comp Act. It's clear under the Workers' Comp Act that if somebody is injured at work, and you know, you don't have an LAD claim or a statutory claim or anything like that, all tort remedies have to go through workers' comp. You cannot claim pain and suffering or emotional distress damages or anything resulting from that physical injury. And in fact, not that long ago, in 2012, this court firmly rejected in the Stancil versus AUSA case the idea that a workers' comp claimant should be able to claim pain and suffering as a result of a carrier's, you know, sort of willful delays in providing benefits, in particular medical coverage, unless they could meet the Millicent standard for intentional wrong. And this court pointed out, and I think it's correct, that if you blew open the door to allow damages for pain and suffering, emotional stress, things like that, it would completely unbalance the entire scheme of the Workers' Comp Act. So the defendant's counsel's attempt to limit their argument in that fashion, I think, would do violence to both statutory schemes. And you have to accept that if you buy the defendant's argument, you are eliminating any kinds of claims arising from any physical harm whatsoever in the LAD case, whether you call it pain and suffering, emotional distress, bodily injury, and it would apply to all claims. Second thing I wanted to address was the point, or the question rather, that was raised by Justice LaVecchia, and I think that Justice LaVecchia, you're absolutely right that the critical issue here is how to harmonize these two statutes. And it's striking that when you look at the defendant's briefs in this case, both at the appellate division and in this court, I think it's 8 different briefs, they never once make even a passing reference to 10:5-3 or to 10:5-13 in the LAD. I submit that if what you're trying to do is to demonstrate fidelity to legislative intent, to completely ignore statutory language that doesn't help your position, does not reflect fidelity to legislative intent. And the legislative history here, as I'm sure the court knows, is that in 1990, in Chapter 12 of the 1990 laws, the legislature made amendments to both the LAD and SEPA simultaneously, all part of the same legislative amendments, that did 3 things to overturn this court's decision in Shaner versus Horizon Bancorp. One was it provided all tort remedies, including for physical harm. 2, it provided for punitive damages. And 3, it provided for a right to a jury trial. Now, it's interesting that the court has faced this harmonization issue in light of those 1990 amendments once before, and that related to the question of how to harmonize the LAD with the Tort Claims Act. And as this court knows, the first time that came up was in Abramont versus Piscataway Board of Education. Now it was a 3-3 split, which affirmed the appellate division's decision, and that was a SEPA claim, not an LAD claim. But it was subsequently adopted by a majority of the court in Cavalotti versus New Jersey Transit, which was an LAD claim. And so it is the holding of this court. And what the court did in finding that under the Tort Claims Act, you could still assert punitive damages, notwithstanding the Tort Claims Act, you could still assert punitive damages for an LAD claim against a governmental entity. What the court said is, you know, we're not doing an implicit repealer. So nobody's saying that because the LAD came after the Workers' Comp Act, that the LAD repeals the Workers' Comp Act. Nobody's saying that. But in harmonizing the two statutes, you have to recognize the statutes, as this court put it in both Abramont and in Cavalotti, they serve different purposes. And in particular, there's 2 things that are different about LAD claims as opposed to claims under the Tort Claims Act, and I submit the exact same argument applies analogously to the Workers' Comp Act. One is that LAD claims don't just involve private wrongs. The legislature has said this explicitly in Section 10:5-3. It involves private wrongs, yes, but also public wrongs. And that's very different from Tort Claims Act, which is just about an individual person who has been injured and has basically a tort claim, or Workers' Comp Act, somebody who's just been injured at work. And in fact, both of those statutes have a very different goal in mind, which is to provide recovery to the victims who have the injury, but also limit the financial exposure for the defendants. So in the Tort Claims Act, there's a variety of ways in which financial exposure for the government entities is limited. And in the Workers' Comp Act, of course, you're subject to the statutory limits on the recovery there. But that's
Mr.
not
Mr. Dwyer, that, like, can I ask you a question?
Yes.
And it came to mind when you were talking about harmonizing, and you mentioned the Tort Claims Act. I meant to ask this before. I actually thought the Fuchsia opinion was a better example of how to harmonize LAD and another statutory scheme, because there our court had to grapple with whether the notice requirements of the Tort Claims Act were superimposed on bringing an LAD action as against public entities. And the court said, well, we look at both. We're going to be mindful of both, but the Tort Claims Act notice provisions do not apply to an LAD action. Is that a better analogy? Or an apt analogy?
I agree with you. The Fuchsia case obviously gets the credit, right? The Fuchsia case was cited in Abamont and then in turn relied upon in Cavalotti, so Your Honor is absolutely correct. That's the first case that pointed this out and that laid out the need to look at what the purposes of the statutes are and made these two points. Again, the first one being private and public wrong versus just a private wrong. And then the second difference that I think applied in the harmonization with the Tort Claims Act, and therefore also applies here with the Workers' Comp Act, is that what this court said in Abamont and Cavalotti is that an LAD claim is more analogous to a malicious or intentional act. And, you know, if you have a malicious or intentional act under the Workers' Comp Act, that's where you would come out of the Workers' Comp Act. So I would submit the only way to harmonize these two statutes is to recognize these different goals and consequently, the Workers' Comp Act exclusivity bar just doesn't apply to LAD claims, just like
well,
the limitation.
Are you using the intentional wrong exception there?
I thought
from most of your argument, you're not talking about intentional wrong at all.
No.
You're talking about a sort of a broader view of this, but then you just then seemed to be arguing for intentional wrong.
No, I'm not making the intentional wrong argument under Millicent and Laidlaw at all. I will be honest.
Do you think if this were limited by comp, this would be an intentional wrong?
So that's what I was just about to turn to.
Yeah.
I'll be honest with you. I have not read the entire factual record in this case. I've read all the briefs, but I haven't read the entire record. And it was a summary judgment motion, Justice Patterson. So
right.
I don't know whether or not there is a factual issue here that would require to go to a trier of fact. Comparing it, for example, to the Laidlaw case. In the Laidlaw case, right, they put something that prevented the bar from hurting the employee. And, you know, the argument of this
removed
court
it.
Was, well, yeah, it was removed it. And so the argument in this court was, well, that was substantially certain to hurt somebody. You know, given the fact that she was having hypoglycemic events on a regular basis, and given the fact that they removed the accommodation that was provided her, was that something that provided that was substantially certain to cause injury to her? I don't know how the factual issue comes out.
I'm not sure she was having, and it's not the right place to debate the facts, but I am not sure it's correct to say she was having hypoglycemic events on a regular basis. There certainly had been no incident involving this before, but be that as it may. Just want to understand your argument. You're not arguing at all that this was malicious or this was within the Millicent framework.
I'm not
arguing
a different framework. And what I was going to say to round out my answer, Justice Patterson, is that I will confess to you that I found the appellate division's Millicent analysis, if you will, to be wanting. Now, whether or not, again, on the factual record in this case, summary judgment should have been granted tonight, I admit that I don't know the answer.
Counsel, the LAD is not a fault or intent-based statute. Now,
right.
I'm not just saying that. I'm quoting Lehman versus Toys R Us.
Yep.
So we can't even try to analogize a claim under the law against discrimination to necessarily an intent-based tort. It just doesn't fit. Am I correct about that?
Well, what I'm saying, Justice Alvin, and I think I'm not quoting word for word because I don't have the case in front of me, but I think I'm paraphrasing pretty accurately, that what the court said in Avamont and in Cavalotti is that a discrimination claim is more akin to an intentional or malicious act.
I know, but you need not. But a plaintiff need not show that an employer intentionally discriminated.
100%.
That's what we've said. I mean, I'm just quoting from Lehman. I'm not 100% paraphrasing.
100% correct, which is why I don't believe the Millicent framework is correct, because if you applied that and required an intentional wrong in order to get out of the workers' comp act exclusivity bar, then essentially what you would be doing is you would be limiting the recovery that this court has said should be held under the LAD, which you should be able to recover damages even for unintentional discrimination.
Right.
And we cited
you could be squelching bodily injury claims in sexual discrimination, harassment, assault cases in the workplace.
That's all exactly correct. And the other thing that I would note in this regard is it's interesting that when you have a claim even under the Workers' Comp Act for retaliation, like under the Lally versus Copy Graphics case, which is 34:15-39.1, this court has said all tort remedies, including punitive damages, are available. Well, that's exactly what I think the argument should be here for LAD.
Mr. Dwyer, I know you've presented a separate argument in your brief on adverse employment action and the required showing. I'm going to encourage you to rest on your brief for that unless there's something you want to present in about a minute or two.
Sure. I'll turn to the adverse action thing really quickly, Chief Justice Stradner. And all I wanted to do was to follow up on something that Justice LaVecchia said about the goals of the LAD, which is, you know, how does it fit with those goals if we're saying to employees, you don't have a claim, even though you've been denied a reasonable accommodation, there's no question that's reasonable, there's no question it doesn't impose an undue burden on the employer. And I think that it's important to understand that one of the goals of the requirement of reasonable accommodation is to economically integrate disabled people. Disabled people suffer from extreme economic segregation in the workforce right now. The unemployment rate for them is typically twice as high as it is for non-disabled adults. The workforce participation rate is a fraction of what it is for non-disabled adults. The poverty rate is typically twice as high. And the likelihood that disabled people rely on government benefits is astronomically high compared to the general population. If we want to end that economic segregation, we have to create a work environment where everybody can go to work regardless of their physical limitations and not have to soldier on, but that they would be accepted completely as equal members of the workplace. Thank you, Chief.
Thank you, Mr. Dwyer. Mr. Folkman?
Good afternoon, Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I don't want to go over what Mr. Dwyer went over already, but the NJAJ does join with NELA in taking the position that if you take a look at the language, and Justice Alvin touched on it, of the LAD, and clearly provides for the right to recover all remedies available in common law torts. There's nothing in this statute which postdated the enactment of the Workers' Comp Act to state that you're limited and barred from recovering from your employer for certain injuries as a result of the Workers' Compensation Act. And this act has been amended over and over and over again. So the legislature has been given this opportunity to limit the scope of this act. And this act, I apologize, but one of the justices had said to counsel for the appellants that they were suggesting that the Americans with Disabilities Act gives almost broader protection than the law against discrimination. The law against discrimination is one of the most broad-based acts to provide for protection for those who are injured in New Jersey, and it's broadly interpreted, has been broadly interpreted over and over again, so that to limit its scope here and to suggest that it's less restrictive in terms of its coverage than the Americans with Disabilities Act, I think is incorrect. This court has over and over again stated how to establish a prima facie case for failure to accommodate, and in none of those cases, as well as in the appellate division cases that follow that, does it require that you prove an adverse employment action. And as Justice Alvin stated, in I think it's 11 out of the circuits, that's not required to prove an ADA claim as well for failure to accommodate. So as far as that goes, I think from our position, you should affirm issue number one. As to issue number two, we do believe that Mr. Dwyer is correct in terms of the language. We believe that the Workers' Comp Act does not bar the plaintiff from recovery here. And as Justice Fernandez-Vina pointed out, the recovery for damages is much more limited in the workers' compensation arena than in a civil action in superior court under violations of the law against discrimination. So,
Mr. Folks, I'd like to ask you for a limiting principle, and that is the statute, the Workers' Compensation Act says such agreement shall be a surrender by the parties thereto of their rights to any other method, form, or amount of compensation or determination, as you know, and it goes on from there. It's essentially saying, and it's been consistently construed, to bar all other forms of recovery or methods of recovery or theories of recovery for that by the employee. You're not here arguing for anything under other than LAD not essentially being subject to that bar.
That's correct.
And I obviously I don't know what statutory remedies could be involved. There could be a number of statutes or obviously certainly common law negligence actions and so forth. What is the limiting principle that differentiates a LAD claim from other statutory claims that may have important roles to play in the view of the legislature and other common law claims that provide recovery and therefore serve an important purpose, including deterrence of negligence and so forth? What makes LAD so different that if your argument prevails, we're not simply tossing aside the intentional wrong language that the legislature enacted a long time ago?
So the answer is that the LAD itself provides the language that permits that. And if the legislature wished to limit it and said subject to the workers' compensation bar, we're going to permit recovery for all tort claims and other cause of action, then that would have been different, but they did not.
But so, the reason I ask this is because other statutory causes of action, presumably that are barred by the workers' compensation bar, don't refer to the workers' compensation bar in them. And I can't think of an example right now, but I'm not aware that the legislature has ever said, oh, by the way, Section 40 still applies here. Instead, the legislature relies on Section 40 to say there is no other claim that's available to this employee. So the fact that the legislature didn't essentially address workers' comp in LAD, respectfully, is not all that persuasive, because I'm not aware of any other statute where the legislature said, oh, by the way, this is all subject to LAD being exclusive remedy, see Section 40. And I've never seen that. If it's there, I've certainly never encountered it. So with respectfully, what can you offer us other than the fact that no comp exception is stated in LAD?
Well, so, Your Honor, if I just may go back, and then I'm going to answer your question. So, again, under the language of the statute, under 10.5.13, it's A to B. all remedies available in common law torts shall be available to prevailing plaintiffs. So that language is expressly included to permit the recovery. That's why I'm suggesting
if I can stop you there. Certainly. If this were a common law tort, it would be barred by comp unless it were an intentional wrong. So
correct.
All I'm saying is if all the legislature wanted to do is to put LAD on the same plane as intentional as a common law tort, that would be subject to comp. So I'm not sure that's the answer. I'm not saying there isn't an answer, but I'm looking for what the limiting principle is.
So one of the limiting principles is to reconcile the two laws. The second thing is in the reply brief of the appellants, they suggested that there are certain causes of action or damage claims that are not barred by comp. And I would suggest that if you accept what they're conceding, there's a difficult way of trying one of these cases. So if you try the case and you can't be recovering for the physical injury, but you can recover for the pain and suffering, you're going to then have to explain to the jury that the plaintiff has been compensated in some way or form through a different venue or a different law, and that she is only here to recover for conscious pain and suffering. When you deal with conscious pain and suffering and you argue before a jury, and I know Your Honor tried cases, when you're arguing that, how do you get a jury not to consider the physical injury? Let's say it's an arm-off case. And they're going to be experiencing this problem.
You have some awkwardness along those lines in a third-party action, too. But I don't know that the practical difficulty of trying to parse all that is evidence of legislative intent that limits this the holding that you are asking for on behalf of the amicus to LAD as opposed to all other causes of action that might arguably have some bearing on this. You see what I'm trying to get at is how big a gap in the comp bar are you asking us to endorse?
Right now, it's very limited.
I get it.
It's limited to law against discrimination.
I understand that, but you know how that goes. How can you tell us that LAD is different?
It's and again, I go back. I default to the language there, and I default to the fact that this is considered to be the passage of this act is to eradicate the cancer of discrimination in this state. And so, if you're going to do that, you can't then, when someone's injured, if they're injured as a result of requesting a reasonable accommodation, and they're not given that accommodation, and they suffer harm, then you're saying that they're not entitled to recover all remedies available in common law torts. We're not saying they're not entitled to a credit, the comp carrier, but they should be entitled to present their entire case. Otherwise, what you're doing is you're encouraging employers here to ignore when, in the case of Ms. Richter, when she asked for an accommodation, she was ignored, then she followed up with an email, and ultimately she was given an accommodation that was then taken away from her, which resulted in her injury.
Can I ask you a related question? Because it's been gnawing at me. Everybody's been talking and raising NJSA 10:513, and you did too, and maybe you can answer this question. It allows for an LAD claim in addition to all other common law claims. But once the Workers' Comp Act was adopted, did it not statutorily eliminate all common law actions for work-related injuries covered by the Comp Act? In other words, everybody seems to be relying on that statute. But doesn't that statute, by its very terms, read together with the compact, not apply to workers' compensation that is paid pursuant to statute that specifically eliminates common law claims?
Well, Your Honor, so as you know, under Millicent, under Laidlaw, there are exceptions to the Workers' Compensation Act for intentional
Understood.
Wrongs.
Forget the exceptions.
So this is another exception that we're suggesting be enacted here based upon the language of 10.5.13 and the legislature's intent.
What exactly is that exception, Mr. Folkman? What exactly is the exception? Could you set it forth for me?
Certainly, Your Honor. Good afternoon. So the answer is that the exception would be that the claim would not be barred, that the plaintiff would be permitted to put on her claim for damages, and then the comp carrier would be entitled to the normal two-thirds less $750 as a comp lien. So they could assert that lien, but that's the exception to permit the plaintiff, in accordance with the legislative intent, to present her claim for damages, not limit it, so that she's not able to recover for something that she made a comp claim for which she was given a chart which has how much each body part is worth. And I'm not a comp lawyer. I just know.
But here's the problem with it is, and you've very consistently with the statute laid out both the exception. There's the exceptional for intentional wrong, and also what you're saying is really the lien in a third party action. You're saying the same thing should essentially apply here, and that may be great policy, but those are statutory provisions, and what you're saying to us is create in this case essentially the equivalent of an intentional wrong exception and the equivalent of a Section 40 lien, both of which are created by the legislature. Add to that a whole new layer of cases in this very sympathetic setting that we're in, and do that by common law without any guidance whatsoever that that's what the legislature wants. If it wanted it, it could do it next week. But it's not there. It's not right now written out that way. Do you see the issue I'm raising? And so if we were to do that, why couldn't some very deserving plaintiff come in and say, I have a cause of action I can just kind of guess at some statutes that might be used. And that also is really important to the legislature. So therefore, that should be an exception like the Richter exception that applies to my statutory claim too. Where does that end?
So, Your Honor, the language itself is the legislative intent. That's the argument that we're making, that the legislature intended for the plaintiff to set forth her claims when she tries her case, that she not be limited. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to go. Is it your argument also that Ladd followed the Workers' Comp Act? The Workers' Comp Act was passed in 1912. Ladd was first passed in 1945, and there have been subsequent amendments right up to 1990 with the right to a jury trial. I mean, so the legislature knew how to limit Ladd if it wished to do it. As you earlier said, it could have been subject to the law against discrimination. It could have, within Ladd, placed certain restrictions. And it did just the opposite. It made it expansive.
Correct, Your Honor.
But exactly just about every statute we have is younger than the Workers' Comp Act, which is kind of the oldest thing we got, right?
Understood. But that language, which is contained in the law against discrimination, is not contained in every statute. So not every statute has the language, all remedies available in common law, tort action shall be available to prevailing plaintiffs. So that language
But here's my issue with it, and I don't want to belabor it. I know, Chief, you want to wrap up this argument. My issue with it is there is no common law action because there's a comp bar. So, yes, that language could apply, but if she were to pursue it in common law, unless she met Millicent, she doesn't have a cause of action. So hinging everything on that language to me is troubling because if we were to say, okay, all that means that there's no comp bar, we're essentially saying that the common law causes of action survive the comp bar.
Well, Your Honor, so what you're saying is because the comp statute, which was passed in 1911 or whenever it was, no matter what's passed subsequent to that, no matter what language is included in any statute, the comp bar is going to apply. So if there's something which says that you can recover for everything, it doesn't say except for what you recover in comp, that is, even though it's subsequent to the passage of the Comp Act, that the Comp Act trumps that, that the Comp Act controls that and prevents, again, this statute, which is supposed to provide the broadest of remedial
measures.
Thank you.
Mr. Folkman, if we accepted the defendant's argument, then when the case went to trial under Ladd, the jury would be able to award the plaintiff dollar for dollar recovery from emotional distress, and yet would be restricted in returning an award for bodily injury. And that would seem to be an awfully strange result.
Correct, Your Honor. That's exactly what I said earlier, which is if you take their concessions as to what is not barred by comp, then if Mr. Resnick's client prevails on issue one and he gets to a jury, then when you go to that jury, how does he present his damage claim? Does he say that there was an injury and she has really bad pain as a result of this, that she lost her sense of smell? And because she lost her sense of smell, she enjoyed going out to dinner. She can't appreciate what she eats. She can't enjoy the aromas that emanate throughout that restaurant. So how do you establish the damage claim? And then if that's the case, then anything else that she recovers would not be lienable. But it's a very difficult case to try, practically speaking.
Can I bring you back to my original question? Because I get all that.
Did I miss that? I apologize, Your Honor.
No. I get all that, and this, I know I got to stop, but Chief, I'll beat this one more time to death. Under workers'
comp. The Chief is very patient with us, Mr. Felton.
I'm sorry, and I apologize.
Thank you, Your Honor.
These questions keep coming up. Unlike Justice Brennan, who's not that patient.
The Workers' Compensation Act statutorily eliminates a common law cause of action for pain and suffering arising out of that work-related injury. It allows for a percentage of partial total disability based on psychiatric or psychological injuries. Since Ladd allows for all common law causes of action, that never, and I appreciate you trying to answer the question. I kind of get where everybody's coming from. But if it eliminates those common law actions, that portion of LAD does not apply. It doesn't relate to that. It's only common law causes of action, not those eliminated by statute beginning back in 1910. And that's what I'm trying to get my head around. That's all.
So, Your Honor, may I ask a question or answer your question with a question?
Go ahead.
Is the legislature able to eradicate the workers' compensation statute completely, and we go to a fault system?
Can the legislature do that? Well, you know the answer.
Can the legislature do that?
So I'm not going to answer your question. How do you like that?
Well, my point is, if the legislature can do that, then the legislature can pass subsequent legislation to limit the applicability of the compact. And our position is that this statute is an example, a perfect example of that.
Even though it only references common law causes of action, which are not.
Common law causes of action are barred by the Workers' Comp Act normally.
Okay.
Here we're saying, because they're specifically allowed for, they're not barred.
I get you.
Mr. Folkman, aren't we... I want to be precise with the language. The section in the LAD that we're focusing on doesn't create common law causes of action. It's just saying when you have an LAD statutory action, here is the list of remedies that will be available to handle if that statutory claim has been proved. And in Tarr versus Sasuli, I mean, we had to probe how do we understand what common law remedies and how they apply in the context of recognizing a statutory cause, of action. So as long as there is a preclusion of not dollar for dollar double recovery, we're not talking about the kind of common law action that the workers' comp statute is taking care of with prompt payment and so forth. We're talking about an entirely separate wrong that is being given statutorily a list of remedies that, because of the legislature's use of shorthand, are referred to as those available under common law. I feel like we are mixing and matching in an area where perhaps we're putting the rabbit into the hat, to use an old expression. Certainly double recovery has been conceded as something that should be avoided, but the damages still end up being presented under the LAD claim, I think. It's a statutory claim.
Mr. Folkman, please close out your argument with your answer. Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you. So Justice LaVecchia, our position is, yes, the plaintiff should be permitted to prove all of her damage claims. And at the conclusion of the trial, to the extent that there's been a lien asserted, then there's going to be a lien to recover so that there is no double recovery, so that there's two-thirds less $750, which is paid back.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much for your time.
We have rebuttal by appellants that's divided. Ms. Droughton, Ms. Ramos, very, very brief rebuttal, please.
I'll waive any rebuttal at this point. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Ramos?
Yes, I just want to point the court to the language in NJSA 10:5-3, which I've been reading over and over again as I've heard the Amici speak. And if you read that last paragraph, you could see that what the legislature was not looking to eradicate with discrimination was to make employees whole for bodily injury claims, which is what we've been talking about. That is the intent of the workers' compensation statute. And if you read, I'm not going to read it because I don't want to take up the court's time, but if you read that last paragraph, I find it very telling that they're talking about personal hardships, not bodily injury claims. And the very last sentence I thought particularly telling says the legislature, since we're talking about legislative intent, the legislature intends that such damages be available to all persons protected by this act, and that this act shall be liberally construed in combination with other protections available under the laws of this state. To me, that connotates that the court already recognized that there are other protections, such as under the Workers' Compensation Act, that the employees are, do get compensated for their bodily injury without having to, without having to assert a common law claim with those defenses, and that has been taken care of. So this is in addition to that. It's not that they get to, I don't read 10.5-13 to provide new remedies. If you read just the legislative intent, they're already recognizing that there are other protections for certain types of claims, and you can see there's nothing in here about bodily injury specifically. And so we contend that actually, if you read the legislative intent, it exactly supports our argument that those claims have been taken care of through the workers' compensation system, unless there are exceptions if they meet the intentional act wrong, which I know we didn't get into it, or we briefed it, that this case doesn't remotely come close to that. But just looking at what legislators are hearing, the arguments, and looking at the legislative intent, it does look like the legislature contemplating that some of those other claims were taken care of based upon other laws of the state, which is here, the bodily injury claim. Also, one last point, I don't want to belabor the point. I keep hearing that the employer would be made whole. Just to reiterate, the employer's not being made whole because we've been told by the appellate division, the court didn't take this up, that we're only getting, if there is some kind of setup, we're only getting 75% back two-thirds back. Because the rationale for that is if there's a third-party recovery that, you know, the plaintiff should be compensated, plaintiff's lawyer should be compensated. In this case, we're compensating the plaintiff's lawyer to sue us, which never made any sense to me. So even under that scenario, we're actually not being made whole. I just want to point out that being paid two-thirds so that we can reward the plaintiff's lawyer for suing us.
I think we covered this. We covered this earlier. Thank you. And thank you to all counsel for the helpful arguments. We'll take the matter under advice.